Yes, as Lucian already said, I'll be reporting on joint work with Chris Eicham. I'd like to start my talks with this quotation, which I like very much. Theory is something nobody believes except the person who made it. Experiment is something everybody believes except the person who made it. I don't know who said that, but if you know, just tell me, please. Maybe I should say before I really start that it's not so easy to talk about all that stuff in 1 hour. But actually, the hard work is with you, of course, because you try to understand what I want to tell you. And there's a lot of mathematics involved, and I cannot skip too much if we have a certain number of definitions and a certain level of sophistication in there to really understand what's going on. But I hope, and I designed my talk in a way that even if you miss a certain part, there are certain re-entry points, if you like. So even if you don't understand something, you can hopefully come back later without any great loss of understanding. The motivation for this work comes from quantum gravity, quantum cosmology, or maybe I should say from the lack of these two. Finding such a theory, which is experimentally testable and predictive, it's proven to be very hard, of course. Today we have several approaches and major approaches, string theory, loop quantum gravity, and a number of smaller approaches. And it's a time where first experimental hints are available or will be available in the near future. But still, of course, a full predictive theory is not really given yet. And apart from technical questions, there are a number of deep conceptual problems that we have in quantum gravity. And two of them are, first is the mathematical formalism of quantum theory is usually interpreted in an instrumentalist manner. I'll say a little more on the next slide about that. The second problem I want to concentrate on is that all physical structures that we use today are based on the idea of a continuum. Mathematically, the real and the complex numbers in the mathematical continuum are at the heart of all constructions that we use. Let it be Hilbert spaces, operators, path integrals, strings, loops, differentiable manifolds, whatever. And this actually is a problem, not to say something about that. But what's the problem with instrumentalism, if you like to call it that way? And of course, that's well known in the quantum foundations. Instrumentalism, I understand this in a pretty broad sense, actually. It just means that the interpretation of the mathematical formalism of quantum theory depends on measurements, observers, expectation values, all these things. But in a future theory of quantum gravity or quantum cosmology, we will have to treat the whole universe as a quantum system. And this means that clearly there is no external observer who could perform measurements on the whole universe. So it's very doubtful how an instrumentalist interpretation could work at all. So the message is we need to overcome or circumvent the usual instrumentalism of the quantum theory. That's easily said, but it's actually quite hard to do. So as a slogan, maybe a more realist formulation of quantum theory is needed before we can make progress in quantum gravity. What's the problem with the continuum? Well, it's commonly expected, extrapolating from existing physical theories that at very small scales, the continuum picture of space-time will break down. But if you take this seriously, it means that when we try to formulate a theory of quantum gravity using mathematical structures based on the real and complex numbers, which are the mathematical representatives of the continuum, we possibly make a category error. And this expression category error can be understood both in the philosophical sense but also in a mathematical sense, and the rest of my talk will basically be about the mathematical understanding of this. But as a matter of fact, all major approaches to quantum gravity. Yeah.
Is it continuum? Like, you can have the discrete Hilbert space, but you still have a continuum in terms of the amplitudes associated with states. Yeah. So which continuum is the problem? Is it the problem with the underlying state space or the continuum when you take superpositions of states, or is it both?
It is actually both. If you look at how we use the real numbers in physics, they show different kinds. One is in the description of space-time itself, obviously. Related to that is how, in which mathematical structure physical quantities observables take their values. This may seem unrelated, but actually, at least in the pre-digital age, we used rulers, things like that. So these are things which obviously use the continuous structure of space-time when you say, OK, you measure distance and assign real number to this. And the third instance where real numbers show up in physics are as probabilities. And actually, all these three uses of real numbers are doubtful in a future theory of quantum gravity. Actually, I can say something sensible about the values of physical quantities and about probabilities in my talk. And I would say that everything that relates to the continuum in the form of space-time, this is for future work. So we'll hopefully see this towards the end of the talk. Well, we have, as a matter of fact, that all standard approaches or major approaches to quantum gravity use more or less standard quantum theory.
So maybe that's fundamentally wrong. We don't know.
So I would say, ideally, we would like a framework for the formulation of physical theories that does not fundamentally depend on the real numbers. Of course, that's a major problem, and we will not get away with simple mathematics trying to do that. And what is the suggestion? The suggestion is to use Topos theory, and of course I'll explain this, as a new mathematical framework in which we can formulate physical theories. And just to give a very first impression, Topos theory is a well-developed branch of category theory, so it was not invented by us, it was developed by mathematicians from the late 60s on, early 60s, and early 60s actually is better. Grothendieck started this in the early 60s. And it is a common generalization of topology, logic, and set theory. So it's a pretty foundational thing in mathematics also. And I'll say more about that later on, of course. But in this talk, I want to show that Topos theory allows to formulate physical theories in a way that, first of all, is neorealist, as we like to call it. And this means that propositions about the values of physical quantities all have truth values. And they have them independent of measurements, observers, and things like that. So it's not instrumentalist, it's realist. And secondly, this framework does not fundamentally depend on the real numbers. Needless to say, a theory of quantum gravity is still a long way off. So in my talk today, I will mostly concentrate on ordinary algebraic quantum theory, and maybe towards the end, make a few remarks on quantum gravity or future directions for this research program. So now we start with the technical stuff, but actually this is very simple, and it's basically a minor of things that you know. So we start with classical physics. If you have a classical physical system, then the physical quantities or observables, I mostly say physical quantities, A, and this could be energy, momentum, position, whatever you like, what physical quantities belong to your system. They are described mathematically as real valued functions on the space of states. So this blob here is the state space. This is the real line. And physical quantity, like energy, is represented by a function from state space to the real line. Of course, the points of this state space are just the states. And in a given state, all physical quantities have values. So I pick one state. Let's say this one sitting here. And then I simply evaluate the function at this point, and I get a real number. And this is the value of the physical quantity in this state. And of course, I can do this for all these functions at once. There's no problem. I want to turn this picture around now. What I want to do is pick a certain subset of the real number. For simplicity, I've just chosen an interval here, and this is delta. And then I take the inverse image under the function, for example, representing energy. And I get a certain subset of state space. And this is an important point, actually. Such a subset of state space corresponds to a proposition. And always write propositions the way A element delta. And this means the physical quantity A has a value lying in the set delta. And I would say, very basically, physics is about such propositions, what we can say about them, how we can manipulate them, how they change, how they acquire truth values, how these truth values change in time. But the main thing here is subsets of state space represent propositions about the physical system, more precisely represent propositions about the values of physical quantities. But we can do more, actually. We have two things. First, each point of the state space either lies in such a subset or not. And what does this mean? Well, the state represented by this point either makes the proposition true, then this is a state in which this physical quantity has a value in delta, or it makes it false. And this happens exactly if this point representing the state lies outside the subset. So there are just two possible things. Either the state, the point, can lie in the subset or can lie outside it. And correspondingly, the proposition is either true or false. So what gives truth values to the propositions is the state, of course. And if I have two propositions, let's say A is in delta 1 and B is in delta 2, then I can do a little more. I have the corresponding subsets. The intersection of these subsets corresponds to the proposition A is in delta 1 and B is in delta 2. The union of these subsets corresponds to the proposition A is in delta 1 or B is in delta 2. The set theoretic complement corresponds to negation. So I have a logical structure given here by the very structure of the mathematical description in classical physics. Classical physics is based on a Boolean logical structure, namely the Boolean algebra of subsets of state space. So in this sense, in this way, classical physics is a realist theory. In a given state, S, all physical quantities have values. All propositions have truth values. Logical formulas involving propositions can be manipulated according to the rules of a deductive system. This just means if I have a formula where the and the or and also the negation of propositions, I can handle this. And there's nothing deep actually to that, because these are just the rules of classical Boolean logic. And this is what we use every day anyway. But the important thing is, if we take this as a logical side, there is a geometrical or a space side to this, if you like, coming from Stone's theorem from 1936. And he said, he proved every Boolean algebra is isomorphic to the Boolean algebra of Clopen subsets of a suitable space. So this is a link between Boolean logic and subsets of spaces, subsets of sets. And of course, the question is, can we do something similar for quantum theory? I said one motivation is to find a more realist formulation of quantum theory. And this has been discussed a lot, especially in the 60s, but it's still ongoing, of course. So concretely, the question is there a state space for a quantum system similar to the classical situation, such that physical quantities would be real-valued functions on this space? And of course, we require that the physical quantities we usually have, and these self-adjoint operators, correspond to certain of these functions. There might be more, but we want to write quantum theory in a similar mathematical form as classical theory, as functions on a certain space, with real numbers as their values. Okay, here shows up the von Neumann algebra of physical quantities. It's not really important. This is, I won't say much about that. It's pretty general, actually. You can think that R is always all bounded operators in Hilbert space. That's fine. But the message is, as Kochner-Specker showed in 1967, if I have a Hilbert space which is at least of dimension 3, and well, the algebra of observables, physical quantities, are all bounded operators on Hilbert space, and there exists no state space model of quantum theory under very natural conditions, very weak conditions, actually. Moreover, it is impossible, for mathematical reasons, to assign real values to all physical quantities at once. We simply cannot think of physical quantities in quantum theory as all having values at the same time. There's no such model. And actually, it holds much more generally, and I could show this in my PhD. Even if our quantum system has lots of symmetries and superselection rules, then you would simply use another von Neumann algebra as your algebra of physical quantities. Still, the Kochner-Specker theorem holds. So there is no state space model for a quantum system.
So John Bell proved this theorem in a little bit different way in
1964.
And he had a very different idea of that these are very natural conditions. He said they were unreasonable.
There is a relation, of course, between the Bell. It's sometimes called the Bell-Koppel-Schmecker theorem.
Yeah.
But Bell placed the emphasis on locality, which brings in a new aspect, which actually Koppel-Schmecker avoided here.
He actually proved that theorem without locality.
Okay, we should discuss this later on, maybe. But I can tell you what the conditions are, and you can decide for yourself if they are natural. The first condition is, I would expect to assign to each self-adjoint operator one element in its spectrum. So the possible range of values that the quantity have should correspond to the spectrum of the operator. I think this is pretty obvious. The other condition is, let's say I have the quantity A and I have the quantity A squared. It should not be arbitrary what I assign to A squared. It should depend on what I assign to A. Namely, what I assign to A squared should be the square of the value that I assign to A. And of course, this should hold for more general functions than just taking the square. But I would argue that these conditions are very natural. Things like that are always open to debate. But this is just like classical physics, for example, works. We want to mimic, in a sense, classical physics. But we can't. And if you like, this again was a geometric, was a space perspective on things, and here is the logical perspective on things. If I have such a proposition, A is in delta, then I know from the spectral theorem there exists a projection operator corresponding to that. And projection operators, of course, are self-adjoint operators such that P squared equals P. And then the Koppel-Schmecker theorem can be read in the following way. It's equivalent to the fact that in quantum theory, you cannot consistently assign true or false to all propositions at once. Propositions of that kind. All of them means A ranges of all the physical quantities of the system and delta ranges of all the possible values, the subsets of R. And this is the same as saying I cannot assign one or zero to the projection operators. And this is quite important actually because we can now say we cannot possibly use Boolean logic to describe quantum systems in a realist manner. And this is a very strong statement actually. But what you should take from this is actually it's not that easy to find a more realist description of a quantum system. We won't get away with Boolean logic and we can't find a state space. Okay, I'll skip this just for a reason of time. There is something called quantum logic, what people apply to quantum systems, and maybe this is so briefly. Quantum logic has lots of problems itself, and this is the famous quantum breakfast. If you go to the quantum hotel, they offer you eggs and bacon or sausage. You would expect to get eggs and bacon or eggs and sausage, but that's not what you get in general. And this just means that the and the or in quantum logic do not behave distributively over each other, and that's a big interpretational problem. But that's all actually I want to say about that. And then I can formulate the central idea of this scheme that we are working on. And if you have not heard what a category is, it's on the next slide, but then just keep this in mind for a few minutes. The idea is, given a physical system S, look for suitable objects, sigma and R in a category such that a number of conditions are fulfilled. First of all, sigma, which we call the state object, takes the role of state space, but it need not be a space in a narrow sense. We actually know we cannot get away with the space. But what we still want is just like the subsets of a classical state space represent propositions, we want that the sub-objects of sigma also represent propositions. So this part of structure we want to have. This R, which unfortunately has the same symbol as our phenomenon algebra, has nothing to do with it whatsoever. So get rid of the phenomenon algebra in a minute. But it's simply something different. This is again, it's an object in a category called the quantity value object. This is where physical quantities take their values. And this need not be the real numbers, actually. And it will turn out for quantum theory, it's something else. And then, just as in classical physics,
physical quantities are represented by functions from state space to the real numbers. We want here that physical quantities are represented by arrows from the state object to the quantity value object. And it is by no means clear that quantum theory would ever fit into such a scheme. That's actually the task we have to show that quantum theory can be formulated in such a way. And it's actually a new mathematical formalism, which does not refer directly to Hilbert spaces and things like that. And of course, that's a lot of work to do. There are some more motivations because we want the subobjects to have a logical structure and we want something that's more general than Boolean logic. All this suggests, at least to people who know the mathematical structures, to use topoi. And so the next task will be to define what is a topos, actually. And before I can do that, I'll have to tell you what the category is. The category is actually a very general notion, and I'll just give you a definition and show a few examples. And there's much more to say, but I have to be very brief here, obviously. The category consists of two things. It has objects and has arrows. They are also often called morphisms. So each arrow F has a domain, which just is the object it starts from, and has a codomain the object it goes to. For example, F goes from A to B, so A and B are objects, obviously, and F is the arrow. Next thing that we always have in a category is that arrows can be composed. If I have an arrow F from A to B and G goes from B to C, you can compose them to get an arrow G after F, and this clearly goes from A to C. Of course, the arrows have to fit together. So G must start where F goes to. And the composition of arrows is associative. It doesn't matter where I put the brackets here. And the last piece of structure that we need actually is that for each object A in the category, there exists what you could call the do-nothing arrow. It's the identity arrow. And whenever I can compose with F from the left, then I just get back F. When I can compose G from the right, I get back G. So this acts like a left and right unit. This actually is the whole definition of a category. One thing I will need later on, there are special arrows called monic arrows, and they generalize injective functions. We don't need the details here. But whenever I have such a monic arrow M from A to B, then I say A is a subobject of B. If you actually think, let's say these are sets for the moment. A is a set, B is a set, and to make it really simple, A is a subset of B. And of course, the inclusion of A into B is an injective function. And this is the thing that gets generalized. Monic arrow generalizes injective function, so A becomes a subobject of B. So what are categories? Actually, it's a really very general notion, and every decent mathematical structure is a category. That's a slogan.
So I would know what a subobject was if I knew what an injective function is.
An injective function is just a function that you have, if you start from two different elements and your set, you also land.
I know it isn't set. When the categories are sets, I know
what they are. Yeah.
Is there a general definition when the categories are not sets?
Yes, of course. A monic arrow is one when you have, I need some chalk here, okay. It's very simple, actually. These are left cancelable arrows for a sec. If you have the following, M is a monic, precisely if for all F1, F2, if M after F1 equals M after F2, and this implies that F1 is F2. This is general definition of a monic arrow. So you can, if you have this equality for any two arrows, F1, F2, you can forget about it. If you think about it for a moment, this is exactly what you expect from an injective function. But this just uses composition of arrows, and you can do this in any category. You don't have to think of this as functions. That's the definition of a monic arrow. Okay. So every set is a category in a very trivial way. The objects are just the elements, the arrows are just the identity arrows. So that's a boring category. Slightly more interesting category is a group. If you haven't seen this before, it's a nice example to think about. And we do not what you might expect at first. We do not say the objects are the group elements. You rather take just one object. I don't have to give it, let's call this object A, but it's not important how it's called. And now the arrows correspond to the group elements. Why is that a good idea? Well, in a group, I can always take two elements and form their product and get another group element. And it's just like with the arrows. I can always take two arrows and compose them and get a third arrow. So this is just the right structure that I need. And the identity arrow actually corresponds to the neutral element in the group. So it's all these nice rules. It's one extra thing that I have in the group, and the inverses. So I have to require that the arrows also have inverses. In this sense, every group is a category. So this, in a sense, a category with very little object, just one object, but many arrows. A partially ordered set is an example of a category which has many objects, but very few arrows. Partially ordered set is a category the following way. The objects are the elements of the partially ordered set. And let's say you have an arrow from A to B. Let's call this the smaller arrow. Just exactly if A is smaller than A to B. And finally, one really big category is the category of, forget about small sets. That's from foundations. That's not really so. There's mathematics in that case. So sets and functions form the category. Sets are the objects, functions between them are the arrows. This is a very important category, which has a name of sets, sets. And this category usually serves as our mathematical universe. What does this mean? Well, when we do mathematics, we take sets, give them some extra structure, and we look at functions between such sets. But this is how we do mathematics, starting from sets and functions between them, and we use Boolean logic to do it. The amazing thing is we can generalize the structures we have here in sets, and every topos is like sets in certain structural respects, and also has an internal logic. So we come to the definition, and I should actually have called this a sketch of a definition, but this, because this definition could take a whole lecture course of itself. It's really a nice subject, but it's not perfectly easy to understand in detail what's going on. So as I said, a topos is a category that is similar to sets. Well, what does this mean? We have two sets that I can form new sets from them in several ways. So let's ask for such sets. And one thing I can do is form a Cartesian product, S times T. Another thing I can do is the disjoint union, by this upside down pi symbol. And maybe the least familiar is this exponential s to the t. What is that? Well, these are all functions from t to s. And the main point is that this is a set again. It's a set of functions. So these three constructions are constructions within this category of sets. Taking two sets, I get new sets. And then I can start the whole machinery of category theory and find abstract versions of these constructions. And then they are called finite limits, corresponding to the Cartesian product, co-limits, corresponding to the disjoint union, and also exponentials. And topos is a category in which all these constructions are possible. Not every category has products or limits or co-limits and exponentials. But if a category has them, it's a candidate for being a topos.
There's one piece of extra structure which actually is the most important and the hardest to understand. Is a so-called sub-object classifier. And this is something we can very well come back to this in the discussion because it's really interesting, but I have to skip the details here. But to give you an idea, sub-object classifier is a special object called omega in a topos, and this generalizes the set 0, 1 of truth values. And that's a hard thing to swallow at first sight. But a topos comes equipped with its own internal logic, and these this logic can have more truth values than just true false. And here is the textbook definition. We'll skip that.
So can you flip back a couple of
rows? Yeah, sure.
Obviously, I'm sort of running as fast as I can, trying to hang on desperately here. So you said we in sets. So a category has objects and arrows.
Yes.
And the category sets contains all sets. But now we have a way, so every object in that category is a set, S or T or something.
Exactly, yes.
But now I have a sort of a binary relation, right? Something that takes two sets and gives me, so you said we can form new sets in several ways.
Yeah.
How did, is that an arrow, or I'm failing to see how that fits into the category theory.
Yeah, that's exactly where I would need much, much more time. There are certain constructions in categories. Some categories have them, others don't have them. And for example, this Cartesian product can abstractly be framed as a product. The product is a product of two objects in a category. It's the simplest thing to look at. Is another object equipped with two arrows to these objects I start from, and they're like projections. And the thing is, I'll show you this. So let's say the one object is A, the other object is B, and A, I would simply write it in product notation. A times B is the product. And I have two projections. Let's say this is projection one, this is projection A, and this is projection two. This is a product, actually, if a so-called universal condition is fulfilled. Let me think how it looks like in that case. If I have any other object C, such that there are arrows to A and B, how do we get this right? Then there's always a unique arrow. This is about a question. You can always find an arrow between A and B and C. And just think about which direction it goes.
From C to A cross B.
Sorry?
It goes into the Cartesian point.
Exactly. It always goes in that way. So whenever I have another object, C, and such arrows into A and B, there's a unique way to find an arrow in here, such that going this way is the same as going that way. It's the first example of what's called a commutative diagram. Lots of them in category theory. It means you have different ways to such a diagram. And it doesn't matter if you go this way or that way. So you start where the arrows start, and you go wherever the arrows land. And it doesn't matter which way you go. And if for every object C that is of that form, has arrows A and B, I find a unique arrow, then I call this a product of A and B. This is the simplest example of a finite limit.
So these are all things that can be written and defined in terms of objects and morphisms.
Exactly. These are all things of that kind, but it's somewhat universal constructions, as it's called. Universal interest means this object has this unique arrow into this object from every other object, such that if certain conditions fulfilled, depending on what you're looking at.
Okay. So what kind of logic do we get in a topos? And this, luckily, is a nice kind of logic. This logic is of intuitionistic type. And this means that the law of excluded middle need not hold. If I have a proposition E, then I just get E or not E is smaller than or equal 1. And 1 here represents the truth value totally true. It's not really precise what I'm doing here. I'm very brief here. But actually, this is how you should think about that. If you take the disjunction of a proposition and its negation, you need not get total truth. You can get something smaller. You would always get 1 in a Boolean algebra. And this is what is called the law of excluded middle. There's simply no other possibility in a Boolean algebra. But this is what we lose in this logic. But it's a nice logic in the sense that we can get an ordinary breakfast there. So distributivity holds. And the good thing is, just like the subsets of a set form a Boolean algebra, the subobjects of an object in a topos form a Heiting algebra. And the Heiting algebra, we don't go into any details here, is just the algebraic structure representing intuitionistic logic. So this is all nice because the subobjects of objects have a logical structure already. And this is one of the reasons why we use a topos and not an arbitrary category, because this is something which is particular to topoi. Okay.
now come back to physics, because I said after the definition we actually want to see what topics we can associate to a quantum system. And this should, of course, have some physical motivation, and try to give this now. Well, there's no model of quantum theory, as we saw, in which all physical quantities have values at once. But not surprisingly, there's no problem at all for commutative algebras. So if a commuting set of physical quantities, I can assign values to them, it's all fine. Okay, forget about this, this is the next slide anyway. Well, just to introduce the notion, commutative subalgebras of the algebra of observables are called contexts. This is simply how people like to think about the context. It's like one classical snapshot on the quantum system. But of course, we do not want to concentrate on a single classical perspective. We want to talk about all of them at once and want to incorporate them in a nice structure. This will lead us to a topos, actually. So we need some contextual model of quantum theory, but with good control over the relations between the contexts. And to define this, we define our first category in this scheme, and it's called the context category. So everything I say would work for an arbitrary phenomenon algebra, actually, but in order to avoid possible confusion, I just say phenomena are all bounded operators on Hilbert space. So this is the algebra you're usually working with. And the Hilbert space itself can be finite or infinite dimensional. This doesn't matter. What we want to do is to consider the category of non-trivial commutative for Neumann subalgebras of the algebra B of H of physical quantities. What does this mean? Well, I just look at commuting sets of physical quantities within this large set B of H of non-commuting physical quantities. Just look at certain collections of commuting physical quantities. And actually, I look at the set of all these collections. Why is this a category? It's a partially ordered set. When I simply say, OK, I have an arrow from one abelian algebra V1 to another algebra V2, I call this arrow the inclusion. Precisely when V1 is contained in V2. So that's all that I do. Of course, I can have this situation and not too arbitrary. Algebras, they may not be related by an arrow, but sometimes one is the subalgebra of the other, then I have an arrow. That's all I do here. And I call this thing denoted by V of H the context category. And the picture you should maybe have here is this category knows about the relations between these commutative parts of the large non-commutative algebra. If I have this V1 and V2, I can, of course, take the intersection. Then I have two arrows, which include the intersection V into V1 and V into V2. And in this indirect way, V1 and V2 know about each other. And this may look like a very weak structure, but actually this is the whole power behind the Cohen-Sprecher theorem, behind Gleason's theorem. This actually is a powerful structure. As usual in category theory, the power is in the arrows, not so much in the objects. So these arrows are important. What is the physical picture behind this? Well, we have all these classical perspectives on our quantum system, and we keep track how they're related. And if I go from one commutative algebra to a smaller one, this is a process of coarse graining. What is that? Let's say V prime is a smaller one, and it contains less self-adjoint operators than V, so it can simply describe less physics in it. Well, that's okay, because I do not concentrate on any particular complex, I have all of them at once. So, yeah.
Do I need to use category theory here? I mean, it's a poset, right?
It's a poset, yeah, you don't need it at this level, but this is just an index category for our topos that we will have on the next slide, and there we actually need. On this level, you wouldn't need category theory. Oh, it's not on the next, it's on the very next slide, okay. Okay, this is something I have to be very brief about, which is a nice piece of mathematics, all well known. The thing is, if I have an abelian algebra, I have something very nice, which is called the Gelfand spectrum. there's a set of all pure states of V. Well, I realized that states may be a little confusing because it's not about Hilbert spaces so much here. Of course, as an algebra, V is represented on Hilbert space, but don't think of a state as a vector in Hilbert space, rather think of it as an algebra homomorphism from V into the complex numbers, because that's exactly what it is. It takes an operator and maps it to some complex number in a way that's a positive linear function and of norm one. So then there's something that's all well known in mathematics called the Galfond transformation. This is interesting because it takes our commutative algebra V and sends it to the continuous functions on its own Galfond spectrum. And skipping all the details, a nice thing here is what we get, this is, let's say, part of the physics of the quantum system. It's one context, one commutative subalgebra of the large non-commutative algebra. But here locally, at V, locally at this abelian part, I can get a state space model. I can write my physical quantities as real valued functions on a certain space. And this certain space is the Galfond spectrum. That's why I introduced that. The Galfond transformation just gives this translation into functions. So I cannot do it globally, but I can do it locally. But as I keep emphasizing, we don't just want to look at one of these Vs, we want to look at all of them at once. That's what we do now. You form one global object from these, what you could call local state spaces. We do just what you would expect. To each abelian algebra V, we simply assign its Galfond spectrum. Okay, so this is one part. But then again, if I have such a situation, let's call this to match it with what's on the slide, just a situation that V prime is a subalgebra of V, then I have this arrow, which is just inclusion. Then I define an arrow between this Galfond spectrum that I assign. And it's an arrow from sigma V to sigma V prime. And how does it work? Well, it takes such a state, it's very restricted to the small algebra. And you may notice that the direction of the arrows is reversed. Here, it's the inclusion of the smaller algebra into the larger algebra, but this arrow goes from what I assign to the larger algebra to what I assign to the smaller algebra. Then again, in Posch category language, this is a contravariant functor from the context category to the category sets, because these guys here, the Galfond spectrum, are sets. And this, another piece of notions is this called the pre-sheaf. This is simply how it's called in mathematics. The pre-sheaf over the context category, and it's a particular pre-sheaf made from these local state spaces. And that's a really important object. And we regard this thing, sigma. The sigma consists of all these local things and all these arrows between them. We regard this as a quantum analog of state space. Of course, I have to say more about that, but maybe it's plausible already at this stage because it's made up of all these local state spaces. Okay, and now we actually also arrive at the topos we want to talk about, and that's the thing. I can look not only at this particular contravariant functor, this particular pre-sheaf for VFH. I can, of course, go ahead and assign to each context another set and to each arrow another function between these sets. I have lots of ways of doing that. And so I get lots of pre-sheafs over the context category. And if I look at all of them, I get something which is denoted this way, sets to the VFH object. Again, this exponential notation. And this interesting thing is this is a topos. And this is the topos we associate to the quantum system. And sigma is one object in this topos. This is the state object in this topos. It's a state object of quantum theory. I know it's been pretty abstract, and I hope that you'll see a little more light in a few minutes. I'll have to skip that. The next task is to represent physical quantities as arrows in my topos. And in order to do so, I also have to identify where these arrows actually have to go. I just have currently sigma, where the arrows start, but they have to go to some
other object in the category. And this is, again, a pre-sheaf. So I have to find R, and I have to find these arrows. And somewhat unfortunately, I have to skip all the nice mathematical stuff here. But here's the idea roughly. What I have to do is at each stage, V, for each context, I need a certain function from the Galfoin spectrum of V to this RV, which I yet have to specify. And yeah.
Sigma with a line under it, the state object.
Yeah.
As from all of the sigma sub V. So you take each every context in the alpha.
Exactly.
And that gives you a state space. Is it roughly speaking the union of all of the sigma sub V's, or tagged by which V it's from?
It is like a collection of sets indexed by the context, because to each context there's one set in the Galfoin spectrum.
Right.
But additionally, it's these arrows. These arrows, again, are very important. It's not just a collection of sets. It's also about the relations between these sets coming from the restrictions of states to smaller algebras. So it's both of them. It's this collection of sets and the arrows between them.
Did you find partial ordering?
Partial ordering is given on the index category, but not on these sets directly. You should think, or this is one notion that's very often used in mathematics, a pre-sheaf is a varying set, and it varies with this index category, which in our case is the context category. This gives you an index, and the index tells you, okay, and this index has this particular set, and another index has another particular set. And whenever I have a relation in the context category, by inclusion, I have also a relation between these sets on the arrows turn around. That's how you should think about it. It's not like one set. A single set is like when we choose an index category which consists of one single index, and not more than that. And one single index, I would say, the index is just fixed. It's one object in your context. And here we have something else which is varying. It's varying motivated from the Cauchy spectral theorem over all the classical perspectives on my quantum system. I keep track of all of them at once and collect them into this large object. And that's the idea. Okay. This is something. Okay, what we have to do to find this, the particular problem that we have some self-adjoint operator, and now we want to find such an arrow between these objects. The thing is, there will be some context, some abelian algebras which contain this operator, but most of them won't. So I have to find certain approximations for this operator. Actually, I will find one approximation from below and one from above for each context. If the operator happens to be in the context, both approximations will agree with the operator, of course, then I don't change the thing. But in most contexts, I have actually to take an approximation. How this works technically is here on this slide. It's a nice piece of mathematics, but it's too much for now. When I get to this point, you can imagine if I go to a smaller context which contains less self-adjoint operators, then in general I have to approximate more. My approximation will get coarser. This is this coarse gradient I was talking about. And the way this actually comes about, this means the approximation from above will give an operator which is larger than the one that I started from. And the approximation from below, accordingly, will give a smaller operator. And then I can find a certain pre-sheaf of what is called order reversing functions, and maybe that's for the discussion. But this is a very natural candidate, and this is still related to the real numbers very much. These are real valued functions, and they take their values exactly in the spectrum of the operator. But at each stage, I don't get a single real number, I get two real numbers. And one is like the smallest possibility, and then one is like the largest possibility. And instead of assigning real numbers, which I cannot from the Cauchy spectral theorem, I assign, if you like, approximated real numbers. So it's like a possible range of values that I assign there. And well, there is some theory behind that, that we get a pre-sheaf actually, and I actually can construct an arrow of the kind I'm looking for and denote this by delta phi. And I should say something, I have to go back, because we call this the Darzanization of self-adjoint operators. It's very important, it's very deep, it's from Heidegger's philosophy.
No, seriously, Dasein is German and means existence, and we liked actually the idea of throwing the operator into existence. So it's not really serious, but we like this notion, and we tried to establish it very much, so I had to come back to this. Actually, this was all using the approximation from above, and I can use the approximation from below at the same time, and I can combine them both. And then what I get is that physical quantities, that is, subjoint operators, are represented by arrows delta v from sigma to this pre-sheaf r left right, which takes into account approximation from above and from below. And this is structurally similar to classical physics, but it's very different from ordinary quantum theory. Okay. One thing I have to be quite brief about, but that's also nice. I said before that the propositions in classical physics correspond to subsets of state space. So we expect something similar here. We have this object sigma. Let's look at this. We have this sub-object sigma. And this is like our state space, apart from the fact that it's not a space, the pre-sheaf. But how did we construct these subsets of state space in classical physics? We took a certain subset of the real numbers and looked at the inverse image. But now that we've represented physical quantities, we can do the same. We can take a sub-object of this thing, where physical quantities take their values, and take the inverse image. And actually, we get a sub-object of sigma. And this sub-object of sigma represents a proposition. And that's all nice because sigma, some objects of sigma carry Heiting algebra structure. So I have a logical structure there, as I said before. And this way I get a completely topos internal construction of propositions. And they do not refer to the real numbers directly because this thing is not the real numbers. It's something more complicated. It's taking two things into account, contextuality and coarse graining. The thing is that the meaning of such propositions must be discussed from within the topos, which just means I must use the internal logic of that topos. So we've done several things now, but one very important ingredient is missing, of course, and as I said, what gives the truth values to propositions is the state. So the final thing I want to do is talk a little about states, and we can represent pure states in our topos in the following way. Well, it's not entirely straightforward because, well, in classical theory, you have a state is simply a point of state space. And something I had to skip, unfortunately, but in a certain technical sense, the spectral pre-sheaf has no points whatsoever. And this fact is exactly the Cohen-Specker theorem. This was what Chris and Jeremy Butterfield did in the older papers already. So this is, again, this interplay between a logical side and a geometrical side. So this thing having no points is the Cohen-Specker theorem. Cohen-Specker theorem, maybe you could read as a logical and as a geometrical thing, and then this is the connection between them. So if this is true, but then I can of course not say the points of sigma are the states. I have to do something else, and I don't have this on the slide, but I can show you the idea basically. The idea is very simple. If I talk about sets, the simplest thing I can ask about sets is if X lies in S. Well, this, of course, is equivalent to asking, does S lie in all the sets containing X, in all the neighborhoods of X? This is true, this is true, and this is false, this is false. I cannot generalize to the top of setting this thing because I would have to touch the points directly, and I don't have them. But I can very well generalize this thing. And that's the idea behind this construction that I will have now. And derive at something starting from any pure state in ordinary quantum theory, and then from a unit vector in Hilbert space, is psi. I construct a truth object. We won't even look at the details. I can come back to all of this if you like. But maybe it's interesting. Maybe it's, we should look at the definition for a second. Let's look at this. I have to define something at each context V. It's again, I have to do something for all contexts. So how does it look like at V? Well, I take a collection of subsets of the Gelfand spectrum. Every such subset corresponds to a certain projection operator in Hilbert space.
And this is like a proposition I can make within the context V. And I simply take the collection of all such propositions which are totally true, which have expectation value 1 in this context. This may actually, I hope this looks vaguely plausible to do something like that. We call this T psi a truth object corresponding to psi. And then, okay, yeah, well, I'm almost there. I said that the topos scheme allows to assign truth values to all propositions. And I now want to show how this comes about. In order to understand this, we have to see a little how the subobject classifier, the internal logic of this particular topos we're talking about, looks like. I haven't mentioned that yet. Subobject classifier omega in this topos of pre-sheaves is what is called the pre-sheaf of sieves. And what is a sieve? Luckily, we have a simple category like V of H, which that's a post set, and there a sieve is something simple. Let V be one context, one commutative subalgebra. A sieve is always a sieve on some object in the category. So a sieve sigma on V is nothing but a collection of subalgebras of V, such that whenever I have that V prime is contained in sigma, then every smaller algebra V double prime is also contained in it. This is what is called a downward closed set. So it's simply a collection of subalgebras of V. There is, of course, something, this is the maximal sieve. And this is a collection of all subalgebras of V. There is a minimal sieve, which is just the empty sieve, which contains no subalgebras whatsoever. There are lots of other subalgebras, lots of other sieves in between. Okay. And again, we have the task not to talk only about one context, but about all of them. So imagine a situation where you have one sieve on every V. V ranges over all the objects here in the context category. And there is a certain condition that they fit together to form what is called the global element. This is like a point of omega, by the way. And in topos theory, and this is simply the mathematical theory, a truth value is exactly such a global element of the pre-sheaf of sieves. This is a pretty abstract thing. That's what I'm trying to sell here. This is the truth values we should be discussing. There is one global element where I have at each V the maximal sieve. And this is interpreted logically as totally true. There is another global element where at each V I have simply the empty sieve. This is totally false. There are lots of other global elements where I have neither the maximal nor the minimal sieves everywhere. And these are all truth values. And so I have a fine logical structure which allows lots and lots of truth values. And actually, that's an interesting thing. The truth values do only form a partially ordered set. There are truth values which can be compared. There are other truth values which I simply cannot compare. That's maybe a reasonable thing, actually. So it's actually, oh, maybe I can actually manage it roughly in an hour. But we saw that the subobject of sigma represent propositions about the physical system. And we saw that states are represented by these truth objects. And I promised that I can assign truth values to things. So let S be such a subobject. P sigma just means the power set. And let T psi be a truth object. And this very simple rule here, actually, I simply collect all the subalgebras of V at H teachers. And the subobject S given at V prime, which is some set, is contained in this certain collection of sets. This gives a sieve on V. Of course, there's something to prove here. But it's not very hard. And the easiest thing you can look at maybe is a paper in the archive in, from December. I'll give the reference later on. So I do this for all Vs, and then I have to prove a little more that the sieves that I get, they actually fit together right in the right way. And they do, and they give a global element of omega. Gamma of omega is a collection of all global elements.
So this is, in the topos setting, the truth value of a proposition represented by S in the state given by the truth object T psi. It's pretty abstract, but it's a nice thing because we can actually assign truth values to all physical quantities that we couldn't possibly do using Boolean logic. We can do in this topos. So I'll come to the summary. I was very optimistic calling this slide summary so far. Okay, what we have arrived at is what we call a neorealist formulation of quantum theory by using the topos, this topos of pre-sheaves, which is directly motivated from the Kochan-Specker theorem. We have achieved a number of things. First of all, we could identify the state object, the quantity value object, and we could write physical quantities as arrows from sigma to r. This is very different than self-adjoint operators from Hilbert space to Hilbert space, obviously. We have systematically incorporated contextuality in the mathematical description just because V of H is the context category, and this is the index category for our topos. We can define truth objects corresponding to pure states. Actually, we do not currently know how to handle density matrices, but there is an integration and measure theory on sigma. And I'm talking to some Dutch guys there, and they have developed that. So there's every hope that we can understand this pretty soon. We can assign truth values to all physical quantities. No, this is nonsense. We can assign truth values to all propositions about the values of physical quantities at once without reference to measurement observers and so on. It simply didn't show up. I didn't have to talk about that. There is a way things are. Things do have truth values. But I have to use the ritual logic given by this topos. And it's actually a good thing that we have a topos there, because topos have a very powerful logical structure, a complete deductive system. So it can actually argue and manipulate formula. And the logic is not arbitrary. That's also an important part of the message. It's not, I mean, there have been lots of attempts to use multivalued logic in quantum mechanics. It seems a natural idea. But one objection always was, why this particular logic and not another one? Who chooses the logic? But here, it is the topos which chooses the logic, if you like, simply part of the structure. And if you think that this is a good choice for the topos, and I would defend that, then the logic is fixed, it's given. We have also overcome the direct dependence on the continuum. This thing is not the real numbers. And of course, there would be much more to be said about that, but last remark I want to make, I have used pretty heavy mathematical machinery, but what we've arrived at is a structural similarity between classical and quantum physics, which previously was not given. And okay, I just skipped to the references. There are many more things to say, actually, but okay, these open problems and goals, so there's enough to do for the next 5 years at least. There are some references. This is my paper on the Kochan-Specker theorem. These are the four papers that Lucien mentioned before, and they will appear in Journal of Mathematical Physics pretty soon. This paper maybe is the easiest entry point if you like to read up on this stuff. It's in the archive in December and Quant PH, and it will appear in the proceedings of a certain workshop. This thing actually is in the archive this morning. This is what Chris and I have been working on recently. It's a long article, over 200 pages, which will appear as an invited contribution in a certain volume edited by Bob Cooper. So this is the most up-to-date, the most complete reference on that stuff. Okay, thank you very much.
I'm wondering how to locate some of the traditional sorts of debates in quantum foundations and everything I've heard. You know, so just as an example, the Republicans usually say that quantum entanglement signifies that there's spooky action at a distance. But the Democrats come along and say, no, it means the quantum states are epistemic. Exactly, what sort of things would, with taking a topos theory account of quantum mechanics there about debates like that?
The debate about entanglement is, this is something which actually is not that easy to see from the topos perspective. But I would say what we can get definitely is a more realist description. You can pose questions about the two qualities of, let's say, the entangled system, and they will have truth values. I do not have currently a worked out scheme how to, let's say, do things like a partial trace or something like that. It would be interesting to see how this works.
But for instance, suppose you start with an entangled state.
Yeah.
Alice is on one side of the universe and she performs a measurement on it.
Yeah.
On the system in front of her.
Yeah.
And then because of the entangled state between the two systems and her measurement results, she now assigns a pure quantum state to the system involved, essentially. Yeah. Has this action now created truth values for that system, for propositions to do with that system that were not there before? Or I think that would be against the spirit of what you've said, because there's a way things are, propositions have truth values.
Yes. They actually have truth values all the time. And the thing is, in a sense, it all relates, of course, to the measurement problem. And I like to say, if pressed, that we take the measurement out of the measurement problem and are left with a problem. We don't describe how the measurement comes about yet. Just say there's a way things are like classical physics, where having an observer or not having an observer doesn't really change things. Classical physics, well, it simply goes on and the system evolves and it's fine. If you look or not, it doesn't matter. And basically all the debates and the foundations are about measurements and also the questions you now ask about entanglement. If I may, I would make a speculation how this can be treated in the topos framework. This may be wrong, but one very important aspect of the whole thing, and I haven't talked about this, is as mentioned here, internal versus external formulations. I said all the while today, we should move into this topos of pre-sheaves and look at the quantum system within this topos and talk about the quantum system and truth values and propositions from the perspective of this topos of pre-sheaves. But of course, I define this thing from the outside. I said, okay, you take the Galton spectra, you combine them in this or that way. So all the while, I am living in another topos, which is like a super topos, and I'm using ordinary mathematics there to define simply the structures I want to talk about, to define this very topos where the quantum system should be understood, if you like. So I have these two perspectives. And this external perspective has a Boolean logic, and the internal has not. If it is actually a good idea to talk about quantum systems using this internal logic, it seems to me that it's a plausible thing to think about, at least if some things like the measurement problem and these questions about reality don't come from the clash when changing from the internal to the external perspective. Because they also change the logical system in which I have to talk about things. There's a lot of work to do, and this is one of the things that really touch upon these debates. But it's a new way to think about that. And to be really fair, I could be completely wrong there. Maybe this is not truthful, but this is my philosophical speculation how we could get at the measurement problem in a well-defined mathematical way, because the whole topos thing has different perspectives. And that's what I would say.
So, the way we normally say it, all of the predictions of quantum mechanics are in the form of probabilities. They can be at 0 or 1, but they don't have to be. So, if this is going to be a formulation of quantum mechanics, you have to recover those predictions, otherwise it's sort of empty. So how are you going to get, where is that hidden in here, or where is it encoded?
Yeah, this is actually, I would say, the most pressing question, actually, and a very good question. How do the probabilities, how can we regain the probabilities? We are working on that right now. The thing is,
I would bear the conjecture that they are all hidden in these two threads. The two threads contain lots and lots and lots of information. Already for a finite dimensional Hilbert space, you have an infinite number of truth values, so they contain a lot of information. And as I said, on the mathematical side, there is a measure and integration theory on this object sigma, and more generally in topology. And then I'm talking to Dutch guys who developed that. And that's ongoing work. So I would say a year from now, I can give a very clear answer to that. I would say the probabilities are, I hope so at least, are secondary, and these truth values are the primary things. We will regain the probabilities from the truth values. That's my conjecture I want to make today.
I guess you partially answered my question in response to Chris's issue. I might be misinterpreting the whole thing, but if I may just rephrase it and
yes.
Please correct me.
Sure.
It looks like you've succeeded in providing a very rigorous mechanical framework wherein both quantum physics and classical physics could be encompassed into it with no possibilities to the real classical challenges. Now, the part that's similar to Chris' question that I had was that you looked to me that you have set all these things up very nicely.
Yeah.
But in reality, when we realize we live in the classical world in terms of measurements, being having specific values, there's a mechanism imposed whereby your larger framework could produce some of these results that would relate from it. Right? So there's a mechanism or there's a process of some sort of a selection from what you have in your mathematical theory to relate to the classical measurements. So probably that if you said that you've taken the measurement away and left the process. So this setup, in the first part, I would view it more like a setup, sort of like kinematics. But what is the dynamic if one starts asking, where does it come from one set description to the set that we're more familiar with?
I was actually mostly talking about the framework and how quantum theory actually fits in there without being specific about things like time evolution. I want to show you one thing. We can do something which is basic, but it's a lot. So look at such a truth object, cheap psi, because this depends on psi. The simplest thing I can do is just put time evolution on psi, and that's all fine. Then the truth object will change in time. That's good. The thing there is that, like in ordinary quantum theory, time is an external parameter. It's not part of the topological structure itself. At the end of the day, and even for quantum theory, but much more so if you want to go in the direction of quantum cosmology, quantum gravity, you want to understand space and time internally. That's what I said in the beginning. This is actually, I would say, apart from the deeper understanding of quantum theory itself from this perspective, the other main aspect is the understanding of space and time, how they are formulated within this topos or another suitable topos, and how they come about. So on a simple level, we do have time evolution. Now, on a deeper level, we have to understand how it looks within the topos.
I think you've answered the question that I was thinking of asking you. But if I limit it to the question earlier, just forget about space time for now.
Okay.
And allow how do you get from all these possible values of psi? Presumably it's identical to what quantum physics would tell us. But you have a more rigorous way to assign true values for all possibilities that we call quantum possibility. How do we connect to the classical world in a better way?
Well, this is the measurement problem, actually. How does the macroscopic definite world come out of
the micro?
And I simply say, in all fairness, I don't know currently. I have some ideas, and this may relate to this internal external perspective.
There is one thing more one can say, and this is actually one part that I skipped. That, if I want to describe a physical system as a classical system, I would, of course, not use this pre-shift topos, but just use the topos of sets. And let's say we have the same physical system, harmonic oscillator, just as an example, once in the quantum description, this topos, and then as a classical description, in sets. There is a natural kind of morphism of errors between topoi. And one can very well look at what these topoi do to the very structure that we have. And Klaus Lanzmann, who started to work on that, he very much hopes that from these errors are called geometric morphisms. These geometric morphisms will allow dequantization or a quantization, depending on the direction you're going. And this is something that has to be solved clearly. And this is, it's of course something I'm interested in, but I don't know much more beyond what I've said now. But it's something we can tackle.
But it's also a many to one projection in some sense, right?
Yeah, it's a many to one.
Yeah. But it comes to the same set of issues that are confronting coherence and many of those more mundane things.
Of course, but it is the measurement problem, which is the deepest problem in foundations. I don't make any claims to having solved that. I just say we have a new mathematical framework which allows new perspectives on that, and that work can be done, and we can possibly think about that in ways we couldn't before. So I think that's all I can say.
Maybe just asking what other people have asked in a simpler or more banal way, but if I imagine a very simple, quantum experiment or something like this, the old chestnut and Stern Gerlach, right? Paired in X, and I have a Stern Gerlach in Z, and I can write down the wave function and so on, but then ultimately I either get an upper flash or a lower flash. Now, you're after some sort of realist or neo-realist description, so you're going to give me a narrative. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm going to have a narrative for this, okay? And I realize this is maybe not done yet, but do you envisage that the narrative will be the same if in fact I get an upper flash or a lower flash, or do you imagine the narrative will be different? And if it's the same, that seems a little bit problematic because at a very gross level, things look different. And if it's different, then it's also a little strange because the standard quantum mechanical thing doesn't, So that's my question.
I understand the question. Basically, it's a similar question. It's always on the interface, the quantum system and the classical world. I definitely see one spot in this place or in another space. I don't know yet. I would like to understand this, but I don't know yet. This is it's a strange thing. In classical physics, which we now structurally have, in classical, it doesn't matter if there's an observer or not. Things simply are the way that observer may read off how things are. But in quantum theory, you always have that reading off, making a measurement, actually gives a qualitative change in some way. So I argue all the while I have no mathematical framework in which both theories look very similar. But still, there are these two levels. There is a classical theory and there is a quantum theory. To understand the relationship between them better is one of the tasks for the future. This will probably mathematically be describable using these geometric morphisms or things like that. I know that's not satisfactory currently. I'm fully aware of that. But it's ongoing work. And actually, we've been doing this for slightly over 2 years now. And that's where we are now. As I said, there's lots of things to do in the future.
So what's your hunch? Will the description of the upper flash and the lower flash in this part be the same or different?
There will be another mathematical ingredient beyond what we currently have now, relating the classical description and the quantum description.
I see.
And simply, it's not in here yet.
I see. So
yeah.
Let's thank Andreas.